Protecting what matters on The Right Choice, AM 1230, KPRL, 99.3 FM with Barry Fisher. Advice and information on protecting what matters most in today's world. Brought to you by Adler Belmont Insurance Brokers and their new associate, Heather Bordan, serving the commercial insurance needs of businesses on the Central Coast.
It's Tuesday. It's 1230. The bear is back in the saddle. It's time for protecting what matters. And by the way, happy St. Patrick's Day. We're all Irish on St. Patrick's Day. So welcome back to PWM. It's the broadcast that helps you become better shoppers and buyers of services and products to protect various aspects of your life, health, and property. We also explore current events, our history, community, institutions, and local treasures that are notable and worth preserving. We have great guests today, and it's all about energy on and water, actually, on today's show from 1230 to 1. I'm pleased to have for the first time, and we'll have her back again. I can tell you that always. Nicole Dorfman, who is a co-founder and board member of the REACT Alliance. We're going to learn about the grassroots education and advocacy to stop offshore wind energy and development, unresolved concerns pertaining to proposed Central Coast offshore wind projects, and most importantly, we're going to learn about where all of our local politicians stand on this horrible idea of putting wind off our coast. Nicole, windmills off our coast. Nicole, welcome to Protecting What Matters.
Thank you so much, Barry.
So, and from 1 to 2 o'clock, we have our old friend Edward Ring, who's the Director of Water and Energy for the California Policy Center. We're going to talk about overstated drought conditions in California, which have led to mismatched policy choices, what it would take to build an abundant water coalition in California, and energy security and why California burdens its residents with taxes and shortages, despite what Gavin Newsom tells us. You can call in with questions or comments, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. And you can also text your questions to us at that same number. So, Nicole, again, welcome. And give us an idea. You know, I think in many regards, I mean, we talk about this wind off. We've talked about the wind projects, proposed wind projects off the coast. And the REACT Alliance is a great grassroots organization that has been fighting this for quite some time. Tell us a little bit about your background and your board's background and what this group is all about.
Oh, thank you. I'm happy to do that. REACT Alliance formed, I believe, about 3 years ago, so we're relatively new. We have been up and down the coast educating the people who live here about these projects because, for the most part, nobody really knew what was being planned. And, in fact, we were being told, oh, it's not going to happen for a really long time, so you don't have to worry about it. But then, alternatively, we were told, well, this is a done deal, so you don't have to worry about it. So we're told both things. But I'm very fortunate to be a part of a wonderful board. My own background is I have a master's degree in social work, and I think you know, the education, the outreach, advocacy, I feel I have good communication skills and just love to talk with people and engage with them. But thankfully, we have people on our board who really cover the range of all the knowledge and skills that we need. For example, our board president, Mandy Davis, is a long-term naturalist, environmentalist. She understands the marine environment like nothing else. She's been giving, you know, in her most recent iteration, been giving tours of the Morro Bay Estuary and up and down the coast. She's very, very familiar, very passionate. She was on the Sea Shepherd. I mean, her environmental activism goes back decades. And when she saw what was happening, she got us all together. I'm very thankful for our vice president, who's Saro Rizzo. He's also our attorney out of Avila Beach and has litigated successfully environmental issues before. We also have, for example, Sherry Hafer, who is very, very familiar with the fishing industry and how they are impacted, and also the marine animals and fish. Her husband was the president of the Morro Bay Commercial Fishermen's Association for, I believe, over a decade.
Wow.
And then we also have a couple people on the board who are very knowledgeable about government workings, mm-hmm. which is so important.
Yeah.
People who have worked, you know, as city managers, port, harbor directors, so understand how all the government aspects work.
And you're really, I mean, this is a single issue organization, isn't it?
Correct.
So you're kind of able to cut across all the political stuff that seems to occur so many times in local politics and advocacy, right?
Yes, we've been very clear. We're staying in our lane, which is offshore wind. Mm-hmm. We have been asked numerous times to take a position, let's say, on nuclear energy or on other kinds of energy. And we just say, hey, React Alliance, we're not going to comment on that. One thing we have done, people have asked us about offshore drilling. And so we have been able to say that we are against any sort of ocean industrialization.
Mm-hmm. Great. So let's talk a little bit for our audience that hasn't heard Edward talk about this topic, and John Pichong is a big opponent of this. You had a great website, folks. I recommend you go to reactalliance.org. It's really a great website. Now I'm looking at the page here that talks about unknowns and challenges. And the first is the location and the technology uncertainties. Could you unpack some of those, please?
Certainly. Well, what's being proposed is really the first of its kind. It would be floating offshore wind turbines. So people hear about what's going on in the East Coast and Europe, and those are really fixed bottom. They're in much shallower water. So the main technical, or one of the big technical challenges, is these turbines are proposed to be about 1,000 feet tall. So if anybody's familiar with the Morro Bay stacks, that's twice the size. Mm. They're so large, so tall, they would need a floating base about the size of a football field. So these are enormous, like a 70-story building.
And how many of these are they planning out there?
They're planning. The first stage would be approximately 360 mm-hmm. of these, and then it would expand well beyond that.
And this is like 20 miles off the coast, this theoretically.
Correct. This is about, so it's in federal waters, mm-hmm. about 20 miles off the coast. So you can imagine, I think, approximately 350 square miles of these turbines in essential fish habitat. This is some of the most productive marine environment off our coast, potentially even in the world. So there needs to be, you know, these massive structures, but then you also need to get, of course, the energy from the turbines to land.
Right.
So one of the things that hasn't been figured out yet, as far as I understand, is cables.
Right.
And since it's so deep, they can't bury the cables, as has been done everywhere else. They actually need to be floating cables, and which means they need to be very flexible. Because mm-hmm. as we know, the ocean can get very turbulent, very stormy. We don't want cables breaking, you know, coming apart. So this technology does not even exist yet.
Well, I'm looking at your website. Each turbine requires over 3 miles of mooring lines. Mm-hmm. What is a mooring line? That keeps the platform in place?
Correct. They're like anchors, if you will.
And those kind of just float around, which has got to be a menace to large sea life, right?
Right. Well, they're very heavy, actually. The links of the mooring chain are about as big as a car. Mm-hmm. They're enormous. They're very heavy. So, and they have to be 3 times the length of the seabed, which is 3,000 feet.
Right.
Because when there's the pitch, when there's big waves,
right.
they need to be able to expand enough. So when the sea is more quiet, those huge chains are going to be scouring the ocean bottom.
And then, of course, it's interesting. I'm reading a history of the American Revolution, and there's a whole section about how, you know, the Americans tried to put these chains across the Hudson River to stop the British. And I mean, again, I mean, they were trying it then. I mean, they're still doing it now, I guess,
right.
with different purpose. And then, of course, it's not just the stuff out in the ocean. It's the stuff that's going to be placed on land. And what kind of infrastructure are they going to need to support this on the coast?
Oh, well, that's a great question. And that's what we're dealing with right now. So in order to have these turbines, there's a lot of support that needs to happen landside. There needs to be three different kinds of ports: manufacturing ports, staging and integration ports, and then operations and maintenance ports. Mm-hmm. And if we're talking about the Central Coast, what we're looking at is the operations and maintenance, which are the smallest of the three. But smallest doesn't mean small. Mm-hmm. In our area, Port San Luis and Morro Bay are the two areas that are being considered for industrial operations and maintenance ports to serve the offshore wind energy.
And then, of course, there has to be even more infrastructure to attach all this theoretical power when the wind's blowing, right?
Right.
To the grid.
Yes.
And that has that been planned out yet?
Well, that just doesn't exist. Yeah. So it would.
They can't just plug it into the Diablo Canyon and send it out into the grid, huh?
Absolutely not. And in fact, they did want an industrial port at Diablo Canyon, and they said, absolutely not. That is not going to happen, because it would have been easy to plug into the grid.
And so obviously, money is being spent on this, mostly going to consultants.
Yes.
This is a recurring theme, the consultancy industrial complex.
Yes.
That takes our tax dollars on these endless projects like Trains to Nowhere, and water projects, which Edward will talk about on the next, after the hour. And the only people making money on this are the politicians, because of all the contributions they're getting, and the consultants at this point.
Yes, I think that's an excellent point. And, one case in point, Port San Luis, in fact, had a consultant, we'll say, named Clean Energy Terminals. They were given a $3 million grant from the California Energy Commission to, plan for this, to do all their studies and whatnot. And it turns out that there was such an outcry from the community that the Port San Luis Harbor Commission had to say, hey, we're going to pause this, which immediately caused this Clean Energy Terminals to back out. Mm-hmm. They were going to get almost $2 million of that $3 million for their consultants and their studies and whatever it was. And in looking at the documents, and we did a public records request to learn about all the communications, it was guaranteed that they would make their money back. Anything that they put out, they would have wanted to have a guarantee that they would make it back.
Wow. So, and of course, I know the fishing industry is against this. Do they have much of a lobbying effort? Because again, we got a pretty big fishing industry here on the coast.
We do, and this would decimate it. The fishing community is already under so much pressure and restriction upon restriction. In fact, the fishermen's associations in Morro Bay and Port San Luis currently have lawsuits against the California Coastal Commission for what they see as improper permitting, and against, I believe, different state agencies, the State Lands and Waters, who also permitted, as well as some of the offshore wind companies, because I know, for one, they started doing site surveys without the guidelines that were promised, that the fishermen were a part of. And interestingly enough, they just came out with, I'm forgetting what agency it was. The Coastal Commission was called the Seven Seas Working Group, which would have been the fishermen, and how do we mitigate this? And basically, their guidelines are that, the offshore wind corporations know what's best. They get to set the guidelines. They're going to determine if there's any violations. And we have all these nice things that we want them to do, but if they don't do it, there's nothing binding.
Right.
So the fishermen are saying, if we even drift in, 1 foot into an off-limits area, we're fined significantly. Mm-hmm. But these offshore wind companies, it's not binding.
Yeah. And I think one of the items that bothers me the most is these wind turbines are an environmental disaster. I mean, they leak all kinds of horrible stuff, sulfur hexafluoride, into the water. And the actual turbines, they're made of some metal alloy that is not biodegradable. I mean, they fail all the time.
Yes.
So I'm always amazed when I drive up through the mountains through Tehachapi, all the wind turbines up there that aren't even working.
Right, about half of them are working.
Yeah, if you're lucky.
Yeah,
if you're lucky, it's what a wasteful project
it is. And you can imagine in the marine environment, mm-hmm. which is much more hostile than mm-hmm. you know on land, how mm-hmm. quickly they would degrade.
So I know the Trump administration has kind of put a stop on this at some level. So let's talk about how that's impacting the picture.
Yes. So the Trump administration, I think on day one, put a moratorium on permitting offshore wind in federal waters. Mm-hmm. So California, our group was very grateful for that. These sites are in federal waters, so they are directly impacted. There can be no more permits to do any sort of development, any site surveys, anything. So that shut that down completely.
Okay.
But what is not shut down, California hasn't rethought it and thought, maybe we need to move away from this. They're actually doubling down.
Mm-hmm.
And what
of
they're
course.
Doing is now they're throwing money at the ports, which we were just talking about, so that, you know, hopefully, if they get a friendly administration in 2028, they'll say, hey, look, we're ready to go. We've got our ports done. We've got all our funding in place. We're working on our infrastructure corridor. So we're ready to go.
Hmm. And you mentioned before we went on air that there's actually a demonstration project
yes.
happening out near Vandenberg. And tell us about that.
Yeah, that's correct. It's a little known project that most people don't know about.
Well, they know now.
It's called Catamo.
Catamo, huh?
Catamo, California Development. I don't know what the MO stands for. But they just received $4 million from the state to do this demonstration project. It's going to cost way more than
$4
million.
This is from the state that is running an $18 billion deficit.
Absolutely.
Right? Okay,
giving it to a private company.
Mm-hmm.
In order to get this money, they had to make maybe a two-page report.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what they're, I believe it's a demonstration project, so they're going to be testing different kinds of floating turbines since mm-hmm. we don't even have the technology down. But the thing is that the water there is not very deep. It's not at all like the 3,000 feet that they're where the real wind energy area is. But the big problem with this is it's right outside, 3 miles outside of Vandenberg Space Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that turbines create a national security risk. They can mask, let's say, an enemy sub. They do scramble radar. And in fact, the military, I believe this was permitted during the Biden administration.
Mm-hmm.
The military folks at Vandenberg really balked at this idea because it was a risk to them. But unfortunately, Representative Salud Carbajal pushed through a rider on some other bill, basically saying they must do this or they will lose money. So that's the state of it is now. But Vandenberg has now said, well, you can't bring your cables in here. We won't allow the power lines to come through. So now they need to make them come to land a different way, which is through a marine reserve. And by the way, through the new, and these turbines would be right in the newly established Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary.
And they would also probably, I guess, being at Vandenberg, create a national security risk, correct?
I believe so.
Blocking the radar and all the other detection
yes.
stuff. All right. Well, on the other side of the break, I want to unpack who's on board with this and who's not, just so because we're heading into voting season, and it's really important that y'all should know where our local and state polls are standing on this. So we'll be back in about 2 minutes with Nicole from React Alliance. Stand by. Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. We're visiting with Nicole Dorfman, co-founder and board member of the React Alliance. For those of you just tuning in, this is a grassroots advocacy group that opposes the windmills, wind energy development off the coast. You can call in with questions or comments, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. So let's, last few minutes we have left here, let's start with the two very important supervisor race, district two races, district two and district four. Okay, district two is D'Antona, who's a Dem, and Aaron M. Woody is his last name. Aaron Michael Woody.
Michael Aaron Woody.
Michael Aaron Woody. He was on with Eric last week, so I always mix them up. And he's running as an independent. Where do these guys stand?
Well, you know, I just need to preface this with React Alliance as a 501c3. We do not endorse or oppose any candidates. We just share information to try to educate the people. So Michael, Aaron, and, you know, District 2 runs all along the coast. So this is the most important district for the offshore wind issue because it would be certainly where a lot of the impacts would occur. Michael Woody has come out very strongly opposed to offshore wind. He said we should not even be going down this direction. We need to protect our coastal communities as if they were Yosemite or the Grand Canyon, he said during an interview. Jim D'Antona has taken the opposite approach. He, when he was the head of the SLO Chamber of Commerce, he wrote an op-ed for the Tribune saying why we must take this opportunity for offshore wind. Mm-hmm. So that's a very clear dividing line between those two candidates.
Okay, so that's really important for the people on the coast to know about. And of course, I mean, there's parts of District 4 that are along the coast. And so you've got Jimmy Paulding, who's the incumbent supervisor, against Adam Verdin. And do you have a sense of where they are on this issue?
You know, my assumption just listening to Jimmy Paulding is that he supports the supervisorial majority wanting this to happen. I did meet with Adam Verdin and to speak about this issue. And what he said is if the people who live in that area oppose it, then I would not want to push that on them.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that's all I know.
So again, folks, if you're out listening to these candidates, you ought to be asking them these questions. Okay, I know where John Pichong stands, and he's going to be on the show again in a couple of weeks, so we'll let him talk about this on his own. Where is Don Ortiz Legg on this matter?
You know, I believe Don Ortiz Legg is an all of the above. I think she has a strong focus on energy, and she really has it in her mind. She wants to secure that we have enough energy. I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. But she is, I believe, for this and for any type of energy development.
Right. And then Heather?
Heather, we're hopeful, is opposed to it, but I'm not quite sure given her voting history.
Okay, so she really hasn't stated. It'd be a good question the next time I get her on.
Yeah.
Get her on the show and see where she's at on that.
Absolutely.
All right, and we don't care where Bruce Gibson is at this point. So
well, we know where Bruce is. Bruce is full steam ahead.
Now, interestingly, you know, I heard you speak briefly asking Steve Hilton a question on Saturday at the Republican Women's event out at the Oyster Ridge, what used the location formerly known as Oyster Ridge. And you made some comments to Steve Hilton. And what was the reaction you got from him?
You know, Steve Hilton, I was very pleased that when he came on, the very first policy he started speaking about was offshore wind in California and how ridiculous it was, how opposed to it he is. So I was very heartened to hear that. And I did have the opportunity to ask a question. I thanked him for that stance. I gave him our material. He said he does want to learn more and speak with us. But I asked him, how is he going to appeal to independents who are not Democrat or Republican? And I think this issue is a very strong issue for any candidate to run on if they're opposed to it, because I found that just in all the conversations we have, once people learn about it and are educated about it, they do not want it.
Yeah. And what about Sheriff Bianco? Do you have a sense of where he stands? They don't have a lot of coastline in Riverside.
Yeah, so. I don't. And I don't think his website talks about it.
Okay. All right. And, of course, the Coastal Commissioner, which is totally no development, is all on board with this, right?
The Coastal Commission has been very favorable to offshore wind, which was really kind of shocking, because their mission is to, you know, preserve the coast, preserve access to the coast, make sure it's clean. You can't have industrial development in coastal zones. Mm-hmm. But somehow they want to take potentially Morro Bay, which is actually a national estuary, and potentially allow a massive massive ships to come in there and industrial development, noise pollution, light pollution, air pollution, the same in Avila Beach, Port San Luis.
And we know where Salud Carbajal stands on this. What about, who's the guy, the northern part of up? He's our guy. God, I spaced out on his name. He's up in Monterey. God, Congressman. God, I'll think about it in a second.
I don't know.
But he's a Democrat, but mm-hmm. he kind of can vote both ways actually.
Okay, well, stuff.
And I'm sorry, I can't remember his name off the top of my.
Yeah.
He's a very famous name actually, and it's I've spaced it out.
Is it Hart?
Pardon?
Hart?
No. He is. His father used to be. Tell us how people can donate and help you guys.
We sure would appreciate any help through reactalliance.org, and just click on the donate button, and that will help us continue to do our work.
All right. Well, great. Yes, this is a good organization. We'll have Nicole on again to talk about where they're at with their efforts and to stop this mess that they're planning out on the coast. So, folks, stand by. When we return after Paul Harvey in the news, we'll be visiting with Edward Ring, Director of Water and Energy at the California Policy Center. So stand by.
Protecting what matters on The Right Choice, AM 1230, KPRL, 99.3 FM with Barry Fisher. Advice and information on protecting what matters most in today's world. Brought to you by Adler Belmont Insurance Brokers and their new associate, Heather Bordan, serving the commercial insurance needs of businesses on the Central Coast.
Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. PWM is the broadcast that helps you become better shoppers and buyers of services and products to protect various aspects of your life, health, and property. We also explore current events, our history, community, institutions, and local treasures that are notable and worth preserving. This hour's guest is one of our regular favorites, Edward Ring, Director of Water and Energy Policy at the California Policy Center. We're going to talk a little bit about the overstated drought conditions in California, which have led to mismatched policy choices, what it would take to build an abundant water coalition in California, and energy security, and why California burdens its residents with taxes and shortages. Edward, welcome back to PWM.
Yeah, thank you very much, Barry. Good to be here.
Glad to have you. You can call in or text with questions, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. So I'd like to start right off the bat here with a study that you guys published in January called the Statistical Review of the United States Drought Monitor. And in my layman's takeaway from this report is that much of our water policy has been based on faulty data in California, similar to the misinformation that was fed to us by the climate change people at the United Nations for so many decades. So if you could take some time to unpack this report, and so let's start with who is or what is the U.S. Drought Monitor, and how do they impact our water policy from a high level? And then I'll just let you roll into what your conclusions were, what you found, okay?
Yeah, you bet. The U.S. Drought Monitor is kind of a consortium. It's a many-headed hydra. There's a collection of water hydrology, meteorological experts scattered around the country. They're mostly federally funded, and they've collaborated ever since around 2000 to produce a report that's updated once a week that reports drought conditions everywhere in the country. And the report had California for, I think, the entire 25 years. There wasn't a single weekly report that didn't have at least some portion of the state in some level of drought. They have, severe drought, exceptional drought, moderate drought, abnormally dry, and then they have, a non-drought condition where the map isn't colored in some shade of yellow, cascading all the way to, dark purple, which would be an extraordinary drought. And you'd see some portion of California shaded with some level of drought everywhere for the last 25 years. And it's interesting that in January of this year, for the first time, they didn't have any of California shaded in drought. But we looked at their report over the quarter century that they've been operating, and we believe, because we talked with the people that do this study, and it wasn't clear that they really had they definitely don't have transparency in how they arrive at their conclusions. And it wasn't clear to us talking with them that they really had a collective understanding internally of how they arrived to their conclusions. We studied their methods as well as we possibly could, and what we were able to infer from what we observed from all of their data and their what methods that they disclosed is that they are representing drought conditions in California and throughout the country at a level twice as severe as in the previous century, in the 20th century. So operating on that assumption, we went ahead and looked at raw station data across California for as far back as it goes, and we dumped, hundreds of thousands of data points into a spreadsheet, and we analyzed the rainfall, the snowpack, the humidity, the temperature, and a couple other variables, vapor pressure deficit. And what we were able to observe from looking at quarter centuries, because you really don't have a lot of station data past 1925. So we looked at the second, third, and fourth 25-year quarters of the 1900s, the 20th century, and then we looked at the same data for the first 25 years of this century. So we had four blocks of quarter century results, and we couldn't find any measurable decline in rainfall. We couldn't find any statistically significant increase in temperature or decrease in humidity. There was a decline in the snowpack, although when we went back even further, because you can get some pretty interesting data based on tree rings, we found that snowfall itself is showing about a 9% decline in the snowpack in California in this quarter century. But if you look way back with tree ring data, it's not clear that that's a trend or just, there are drought conditions that have existed in California that have lasted centuries, if you go back thousands of years looking at tree ring data. So to make a long story short, we weren't able to corroborate the idea that's put forth by the U.S. Drought Monitor that we are in an extraordinary drought. Obviously, we need to be able to manage the situation if more of our water is coming from rain and we're not getting to save some of it up on the top of the Sierra Nevada mountains for summer. That requires some adaptation. But in terms of, for example, suggesting that our forests are burning because of higher temperatures and less rain is simply false. The data that we were able to look at, and we looked at a lot of it, I think we looked at more of it than they've probably looked at for the previous century, just doesn't suggest that we're in a period of extraordinary drought.
So again, how has this impacted policymakers' decision making over the last 25 years, or even the last 10 years? I mean, again, if they're
been very influential.
Yeah.
When they see those shades of red smearing over the map of the state of California, that's influences water agencies, it influences the state legislature, it influences the state water board. It's something that environmental groups will rely on. It's considered a very credible source of information on the state of California's hydrology. And that's another thing. The Drought Monitor doesn't have any connection to how much water we've actually got stored. So, for example, if we've had three wet years, which we have, and our storage is relatively full, and it ought to be even more full, we should have even more water stored, but that's a policy decision. We're not going to go into a so-called hydrological drought where we don't have enough water to irrigate our crops or transport to our cities. Even if we had a very dry year, even if it never rained again in this particular season, we would have plenty of water. And the Drought Monitor doesn't measure that. It only looks at weather conditions.
So really, it's caused our policymakers to create even more man-made disasters in the state. I mean, you think about how it impacts agriculture. They shut the water off to the Central Valley based on this kind of stuff, right?
Well, they do, and there's a lot of consequences of that. If you, you know, we could go on, we could talk the whole hour about the negative consequences of shutting off water to the farmers. You know, a lot of that water, they ought to be releasing that water when they have storms, and just recharging the aquifers would be a major step forward. If you got a little bit more water into those, you could take some out. You could be still recharging the aquifers while also relying on it for some of your water. That sort of option is just taken away when they stop shipping water south.
Yeah. So shifting gears, and we'll just shift right into this. I mean, you worked with Steve Hilton, you know, gubernatorial candidate, who was here just a few days ago and spoke to spoke to a group of people here. He had a good crowd. And you helped him with creating a program. This goes back into August, where it's called Achieving Water Abundance, a new approach based on positive common sense ideas. So this is basically Steve's idea of getting some sanity to our water policy in California. What were the high-level conclusions of this report that you did?
Well, I like the way Steve thinks. I have an insight into how he thinks about policy because I did work with him on 10 policy papers, including water and including one on energy. And, you know, the fundamental philosophy is you can't ration your way to abundance. You can't conserve your way to abundance. You take away all of the resilience. Even if you're successful through conservation in balancing the budget so that there's enough water supply to meet water demand, the problem with that approach is if anything happens to the whole system, you end up with a very serious crisis. You need water abundance because if something happens, there's a earthquake that liquefies levees in the Delta. That's the classic disaster scenario. Or there's a cyber attack and the Tehachapi pumps, you know, throw a couple of pistons and everything shuts down for a couple of years. You know, you can pick your disaster. But if we have one, all of a sudden there's no resilience in the system. You need to have a water supply that comes from the, you know, and it's a cliche, but all of the above strategy, especially for water. You need everything from seawater desalination to more surface storage, more underground storage, more runoff capture, more wastewater recycling. You need everything, and you need to create surplus water. There's even a lot of evidence that if we just had more water in our cities, we would mitigate the heat island effect, and we would actually have less required irrigation because we would keep the temperature down. There's all kinds of interesting, very contrary views to the way state policy is designed today. But, you know, what Steve's trying to get at, and I agree completely, is that, we can't conserve our way to abundance. And they talk, but Democrats have picked up on the abundance theme. You know, this is something we've all been talking about for a very long time. All of a sudden, the Democrats grabbed it, and that quickly morphed into affordability. But you just can't achieve those things through rationing and through top-down centralized solutions. You have to have a diverse sources of water, and you have to deregulate the permitting environment so that it's not at a prohibitive cost to invest in and build all of these water supply assets that we need.
Well, and the underlying issue here, and I'm looking at the key points of this report, and folks, you can get all of Edward's work, find it all on the California Policy Center website under the Water tab or Energy tab. He's prolific in this stuff. But, you know, you basically point out that we got, you know, a water infrastructure that was built for 20 million people, and now we got 40 million people in the state. And this is unsustainable, and we're wasting money on other things that are not as important. I mean, that's the bottom line that, you know, voters should be thinking about when they go to the polls in June and then, of course, in November. So this and one of the things that you just wrote a few articles on is desalinization. So I'd like you to take the rest of this segment, which is about 3 or 4 minutes, to talk a little bit about why large-scale desalinization should be in California, and who's what would that take, and who's against it again? This is common sense stuff. Why is it not happening?
Well, there's three arguments: environmental, and then the financial cost to build it, and the energy cost. And each of those you can debunk pretty fast. I mean, in 3 minutes, I can tick through as quickly as possible. The environmental arguments are just ridiculously overblown. You just spent, about an hour talking about the impact of floating offshore wind, where you have thousands of these massive turbines with cables going down to the sea bottom, 4,000 feet down, and high-voltage cables going 20 miles to shore, and basically industrializing the coast to receive all this stuff and to stage all of this construction. And you compare that to a desalination plant that they rejected in Huntington Beach that was going to sit on
acres. Edward, I've got a call coming in. Let's hold your thought. Let's take this call.
Please.
Thanks for calling Protecting What Matters. What's your question for Edward?
I have a couple concepts that I wanted to see how close to the truth I was.
You got a couple minutes here, so make it quick concepts.
We stopped dredging the Sacramento River a while back, and that, we knew that was kind of a problem, but we refused to go back and re-dredge it, and how that affects our abilities in the state is kind of an intentional limitation we gave ourselves. And the other one is, I'm curious, when I hear the governor say Delta Smelt, I think what he's talking about is we have so many people polluting the San Francisco Bay that we have to flush it out all the time or else it'll become a septic tank. Are either of those concepts close?
Thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
Edward, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm glad he brought up both of those points, because there's, starting with the Bay, there's, I think, 37 seawater desalination plants surrounding the Bay and in the estuary portions of the Delta, and they put out 400,000 acre-feet of effluent, inadequately treated sewage that's still very nitrogen-rich, and that causes algae blooms, and then the algae dies and creates dead zones. And, yes, they have to flush more water through the Bay instead of cleaning up those water treatment plants to a higher level of treatment. That's number one. The caller is also, I believe, absolutely correct about dredging. If we were to, we could talk an hour about dredging, but, if you got the channels in the Southern Delta especially back to their historical depths, you would increase the water volume, which means you could pump without draining the water so that Delta farmers can't irrigate anymore. You would also make it so you could operate the pumps longer before you would be pulling salt water in from the ocean. You would also make it possible to get more water during flood events out of the Delta, so you could save more water in the reservoirs. You wouldn't have to reserve space for quick runoff. So there's more. I mean, salmon like the deeper channels. So dredging is essential. Cleaning up the water treatment plants is also essential.
So back to these, and again, what you're talking about here is, again, that all of the above, policy that we need to be doing a lot more, and again, back to desalinization. What are the pros? What are the cons? Real quickly, we got about another minute left in this segment.
Well, the environmental issues are, I think, negligible by comparison to other things out there. We have the California Current to take the brine and disperse it. We can get the residual chemicals from filtration out of the brine before it's released. The costs aren't as high as, the costs are coming down. The energy costs as well are much lower than people say. I can hear the music in the background.
Yeah.
I can give you the numbers, but we'll have to save it for later.
Let's do it on the other side of the break, and then we'll talk about energy when we return with Edward Ring. Edward, I'm going to put you on hold for 2 minutes. Stand by, everybody. Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. We're visiting with Edward Ring, Director of Water and Energy Policy at the California Policy Center. Call in or text with questions, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. Let's wrap up on the desalinization here, Edward. I mean, because, you know, we live in a state that spends money like a drunken sailor, but they're not, but here's a technology and an opportunity that they just shut their eyes to here. What's the story?
Well, you know, to try to get through this pretty quickly, to start with, you have to think big when you talk about desalination, because it's something that's in the world, 40 million acre feet a year of fresh water is being pulled out of the world's oceans. They're doing it everywhere. They could easily do it here. We have ideal conditions. We have a quick drop-off on the continental shelf. We have a very strong current. Everything that you need in terms of minimizing the environmental impact is present here in California. It's an ideal place. Look at how you could finance this, for example, by offsetting water from the Colorado River. We import 800,000 acre-feet into California's coastal cities in Southern California through the Colorado Aqueduct. There's a lot more that goes to farming in the Imperial Valley, but let's just talk about that 800,000 acre-feet. If you wanted to replace that with desalinated water, it would cost about $14 billion to build the plants. Now, that sounds like a lot, but if you finance that at 4% interest on a 20-year bond, it actually comes out to about $900 per acre-foot. Now, we're buying water from the Metropolitan Water District of Los Angeles in Southern California at $1,500 an acre-foot, and that price is going to double in the next 10 years as they start investing in getting PFAS out of the water and so forth, which you don't have with desalinated water. You could give that water back to Arizona and Nevada, and they would pay the financing costs, because that's cheap water for the cities of Las Vegas and Phoenix. That means all you'd have to pay is the energy and operating costs in Southern California for that 800,000 feet of water. Now, at 8 cents a kilowatt hour, that's $300 an acre foot, which is not very much when you're spending on a retail basis $2,500 per acre foot, on a wholesale basis $1,500 per acre foot, and the numbers are going up. When you talk about the energy, by the way, you know, it's 3,500 kilowatt hours per acre foot. To put that in perspective, the Diablo Canyon power plant, which puts out 2 gigawatts, would be able to desalinate 5 million acre feet a year. All you do is leave Diablo Canyon open and you have enough electricity to desalinate 5 million acre feet. I could give you other examples. It takes the same amount of energy to pump the water over the Tehachapi that it would take to desalinate the water. So energy is not an issue either.
We got a caller here. What's your question for Edward?
Well, I spend a lot of time up in the Delta, and I know that they're trying to do all these environmental things, but a proposal was made, 10, 15 years ago. It's a lot easier to desalinate brackish water as opposed to seawater. And right there at the right near the Antioch area where the Sacramento River comes into the bay, it's brackish water. It's half salt water and half clean water. And you could easily build a desalination plant on one of the islands out there that the state owns already. And on another island, you put a big, huge solar plant. There's tons of wind around there, and you got wind, so that makes everybody happy because you're saving the smelt, you're desalinating the bad water, you're using solar and using air, and everybody's happy. So what's your thoughts on that?
Thanks for your call.
I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you. Edward, what do you think?
Well, I think that brackish water desalination has a lot of potential as well, and there are situations where you can get it from the ground, or you can get it from groundwater that's replenished really fast. There's a company in down in the Mojave Desert area, Cadiz, that's working on some ideas that can harvest brackish water. And you're right, it costs, depending on how brackish it is, it's about half as much energy and about half as much operating costs. The thing about taking it out of the Delta, that's a good idea, and Antioch's already doing it on a small scale, the city of Antioch. But why not just go a little further upstream and take fresh water out and pump it into the aqueduct? I think one of the things with the Delta, that if we could get rid of some of the issues that dredging would solve and that fixing our wastewater treatment plants would solve, And then we had, and there's examples out of what could be done. It's not just the tunnel. There are other options that would cost less. If we could safely take more fresh water out of the Delta during winter storms, you're looking at millions of acre feet of fresh water that could be harvested without having to go a little further into the estuary and desalinate brackish water. So it does have a utility, or the city of Antioch wouldn't be doing it. But I think that's, you know, part of a portfolio, and maybe just getting that fresh water further upstream, if we could just figure out how to do that during our big storms in a safe manner. And there are ways to do that. Might be more cost effective.
All right. We're going to shift gears to energy here now. We'll bring water into the kind of the close here. You wrote an article back in January stating that the common denominators of prosperity in California is energy and water, our energy and water. And some of us are still interested in prosperity and economic development in this state, at least, you know, a portion of us. Why do you say that these are the two things that we really need to harness in a proper way to move the state forward again?
Well, it makes everything else easier. I mean, the argument with energy is pretty cut and dry, because all fuel is, it's used in whatever you've got, whether it's a tractor in the fields or shipping on land, sea, and air. All of our shipping requires energy. Every building, everything we do requires energy. So if you have inexpensive energy, that cost as a percentage of whatever it is you're producing or shipping or consuming goes down. So, you know, it's pretty obvious, I think, that we need more energy. Water, it's a direct influence, perhaps in several obvious ways, maybe not pervading the entire economy, but certainly our farm economy, any water-intensive manufacturing. Data centers need water now, although I think they can recycle the water. They just have to invest a little bit more to have that capacity. But water as well is something that will roll into the cost of everything else. So, and there's also a quality of life element to prosperity. Do we really want to have these messy heat island xeriscapes, you know, with plastic, with rocks on top, and a couple of cactus growing in every front yard in Los Angeles?
Kind of like Phoenix, huh?
Well, and we're not Phoenix.
That's right.
We can stick a straw in the ocean and have all the water we want. And we have a lot of rain. We have a tremendous, 200 million acre feet of water in an average year fall into California watersheds. We just have to manage it. So, I'm sticking to that story. I believe water and energy are fundamental. Obviously, there's other things that are fundamental. We have to deregulate our whole economy to make it possible, for example, for private developers to be able to build an affordable house and still make a profit without subsidies. And to do that, we have to deregulate land development. And we have to invest, again, in water and energy infrastructure so that that's in place, so it's possible to build new homes. There's plenty of room in California. We could use up a small, tiny fraction of that and have all the room for new homes we'd ever want.
Yeah, but that's a big, huge problem for us. We have another. You are very popular today, Edward, so we got another caller. And caller, there was a lot of background noise, so please mute your background. So we're going to try it again.
Is it any better?
It is now. Thank you very much.
Hey, not a problem. In answer to your question, do I want cactus and rocks in everybody's front yard? Yes, as a matter of fact, and especially in the freeway medians. I looked at it in San Luis Obispo. They're probably spending how many millions of dollars to redo all the little islands in the freeway? What's wrong with a few rocks and a nice sculpture?
Well, is that a question or just a comment?
Both.
All right. What do you think?
I'm serious. No. I'm very serious.
Well, you're right. Edward, what do you think? Thanks for your call.
Well, you know, it comes back to how much does it cost to do all this stuff. If we had a little bit less, I think, how do you put this? You kind of stumped me a little bit there, because I agree with the concept that we want to be efficient with how we use our resources. But it comes back to, if we had less regulation, less redesigns, less bureaucracy, and we just went out there and did some of this stuff, it wouldn't be at a prohibitive cost. And then the question is, well, what kind of a barrier do you want in between your northbound and southbound lanes? I think oleander will probably stop a car better than a concrete statue.
Yeah, my oleanders do that for sure.
It might be a little easier on the driver.
Yeah.
But, and I think aesthetics matter. I don't think we should strip everything down to the bone in order to save a little money. We need to use the money more efficiently. Things that cost $1 million could probably be constructed for $100,000 in some cases if we weren't so bureaucratic about how we get things done. So I would start there before I would, put concrete wherever we might be able to have landscaping.
When you can't do the development for that inexpensive when you have to hire so many consultants to consult on the project. I mean, that's
exactly right.
It's
become really hard to just get out the equipment, get the guys that do real work, and just send them out and tell them to go to work. You have to have millions of rounds of consultations and hearings and process, and everybody's got to get involved. And that doubles, triples, or more the
yep.
cost of things. And so fix that, and then we'll see if it's still worth, paving over our medians.
So, days before we went into Iran, you wrote an article, again, called The Delusions of Davos and Dubai Versus Realistic Pathways to Global Energy. So it was an interesting article, and I know you were reviewing what happened at the COP28 summit in Dubai. What were the high-level points, and what has changed in your mind now that we're dealing with Iran as we have in the last few weeks? How does that change the worldwide energy picture, which really impacts California because we get so much of our oil from overseas in California?
Yeah, we do. I mean, the cost per gallon before the war was based on about low 60s per barrel. And that translates to $1.50. In other words, in your price at the pump, $1.50 of that $4 or $5 or $6 per gallon is the crude oil. Mm-hmm. So if the crude oil goes to 100, let's say it goes to 120, that's $3 of whatever you're paying at the pump instead of $1.50. Those costs are passed through. So, that does affect us, obviously. It affects everyone on Earth. When you have a spike in the price of crude oil, it affects everyone on Earth. What was in that article, one of the main points of that whole thing, and I just go to, the Statistical Review of Global Energy, which is a very reliable, authoritative source that is renewed, updated once a year. We've been using about 80% fossil fuel to power the planet's economy for the last several decades. It hasn't moved.
Mm-hmm.
Renewables, so-called renewables, have increased in terms of their absolute production, but the entire consumption worldwide has been increasing at the same pace. So they continue to only represent about 20%. Oil, coal, natural gas are 80%, and that's true in America. That's true in China. A little bit more coal in the mix, but it's 80%. It's 80-20. It's 80-20 in California. We're 50% petroleum, 30% natural gas, and 20% everything else. That's roughly the same as the U.S., and again, and worldwide, that's roughly the same, a little more role for coal. So the point of the article was, they talk about doubling nuclear. Well, if nuclear is only 4% of total global energy, you can double it all you like. The other point, the same goes for hydroelectric. And nobody, hydroelectric, you can't scale that. You might be able to double it. Nuclear, you might be able to triple or quadruple. But you're still looking at a big challenge, which is that for everybody on Earth to use half as much energy as Americans do per capita, you have to double the energy production in the planet. And you're not going to get there without coal, oil, and gas, not for a long time. So we have to accept that. And as a state, we ought to be setting an example of how to use, for example, natural gas in a super efficient way, because they're not going to stop using it in the rest of the world. That's absolutely not going to happen.
Well, and the use of natural gas worldwide has spiked, and that's had a really good effect on environmental problems, isn't it?
Well, you know, you can look at it two ways. You can say, what's the carbon intensity of natural gas versus coal? And it's a lower carbon intensity with natural gas, and people who worry about CO2 applaud that fact. But there's other benefits to natural gas, which is it's just a cleaner fuel. It's a lot easier to scrub all the genuine pollutants out of natural gas emissions compared to coal emissions. So whether or not you're concerned about atmospheric CO2, natural gas is a cleaner fuel.
Yeah. Switching to gasoline prices in California, you know, Governor Newsom is being pilloried in the press for saying that claims that California has lower taxes than Texas and Florida. He doesn't, and that their systems are more regressive tax systems, which hurts the middle and lower class. What he fails to point out, or and it should be pointed out, is that our high gas taxes, as well as where our prices are going at the moment, are even more hurtful to the middle class. So, I mean, you've long been predicting California is going to be having gas lines and $8 a gallon gas, at least since you've been on the show here. I mean, are you still seeing that? I mean, what's our future look like here in California from a gasoline price perspective?
Well, you know, it was that professor down at USC, I think his last name is Mishka, who came out with a well-publicized study predicting $8 a gallon gasoline. There's two ways that you're going to get gas lines and prices that high. One is if something, they're shutting down our refineries, and they're making up for that by importing refined gasoline. Now, if they drive our refineries out of the state faster than they can bulk up to import refined gasoline from elsewhere, then you're going to have a severe shortage, and you're going to have gas lines and $8 gas. Now, is that going to happen is kind of up to the state legislature and the California Air Resources Board and some of the people that are running the state. I believe Chevron just sent a letter to the Sacramento saying, if you go through with some of these next rounds of carbon credit auction required payments, we're leaving. So if that happens faster than they can import refined gasoline, you're going to have the lines, you're going to have the super high prices. And the problem with importing the refined gasoline, that will add about 50 cents to the price of a gallon of oil. Now, right now, that's still only about 5% of our gasoline that we have to import based on the two refinery closures we've just seen. We're about 5% short in our refinery capacity. You import gasoline that costs 50% more because you have to ship refined gasoline from overseas instead of making it here, but it's only 5% of the mix. That won't translate into a 50% bump. But if it gets really bad because we lose a couple more refineries and we're not able to even bring it in because we don't have the capacity in our ports and our, you know, it's not the same facilities to process crude oil that it is to process refined gasoline. So everything has to be built out. It takes time. So that could be one source. The other one, of course, is the war. You know, nobody was sure if and when there was going to be a war, but when you have the Strait of Hormuz closed up, obviously, that's going to cause these price spikes as well. If we didn't have the war, and if they quit driving our refineries out of state, we probably could prevent the gasoline prices from going much higher. And, of course, they're already way too high compared to other states.
What about the Trump administration's efforts to use the Defense Production Act to restart California oil operations off of Santa Barbara? I mean, that's not going to really help either, even if it happens, because we don't have the refining capacity, right?
Well, the crude oil imports and the refinery capacity are related. I mean, we produce about 300,000 barrels a day in-state crude oil. And you have the Santa Barbara Channel, the Sable wells, 50,000. That's going to bump our crude oil supply by 16%. But you're right, Barry, that's not going to make up for the fact that we're in a pinch in terms of refinery capacity. Is our gasoline consumption dropping enough right now to make up for that 4 to 5% shortfall between supply and demand right now, refinery capacity and gasoline demand? I don't know. That's where prices lower demand, and then you get your equilibrium back.
Well, we'll see. Edward, hang on. We got one more segment. Folks, we will return with Edward Ring. We'll wrap up with our conversation about energy and water and take any of your questions. I'm really happy everybody's so engaged with today's topics. So stand by. Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. We're visiting with Edward Ring, Director of Water and Energy Policy at the California Policy Center. Call in with questions or comments, 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. Next week's show is going to feature Karen Talon from the Groves on 41. We're going to call it Olive Education Day on a PWM, and I'm sorry for saying I'm not sure what's wrong with my brain, but Olive Education Day on Protecting What Matters. We will be talking about all the things you can eat olive oil on and how you can prepare foods with it. It's going to be a great show. And then for the 1 o'clock hour, we're going to have Joel Peterson, CEO of the Paso Robles Wine Country Alliance. Edward, we got one more topic I wanted you to kind of touch on primarily, and then I want to know what you're looking at over the next few months that are going to be things that our audience should be listening to about, but issues. But you wrote an article about why data centers will create electricity abundance. There's been a lot of buzz that these data centers that are being built for AI are going to hurt particularly rural communities because there's going to be such a energy suck that it's going to raise prices dramatically. You have a contrary a view on this a bit, and you see it as an opportunity.
Well, first of all, I think there's going to be examples of exactly what you described. So while I think that it's important to point out the upside, because there is some upside to all of this, that doesn't mean we're not going to have examples where exactly what you just described is happening and there's, you know, all of a sudden electricity shortages. These data centers are migrating to places with the cheapest electricity, and obviously if they have a deregulated environment and cheap electricity and they can get an interconnection to the grid right away, whereas, you know, here in California it would take them forever, they're going to go there, they're going to get hooked up to the grid, and all of a sudden there's going to be electricity shortages. And that's a scenario that I'm not trying to deny. What I do think is an opportunity, though, is in states like California, where they want to have these data centers, and they're building some huge data centers in the Imperial Valley right now, and there's sites all over California, they have to wait too long to get a utility interconnection, and they have to wait too long for all of the permits that they're going to need if they want to consume a lot of electricity. So what they're doing instead is putting on-site reactors at their data centers. And there's two things here. That, first of all, they have more money than most private investors have ever had. These guys don't have to worry about their budget. They can spend whatever it takes to build electricity generators. The other thing is they're not accustomed to the decade-scale timelines that utility bureaucrats and state bureaucrats are comfortable with. These are guys that are used to product launches where they go from, you know, start to launching a product in 12 to 18 months. So they have an expectation of making rapid progress. And finally, these are innovators. So these are people that are going to use every kind of energy production, energy generation technology, whether it's conventional and established or emerging and experimental, and they're going to pour money into it. They're going to stimulate innovation in energy production that we really haven't seen up till now, because they have all this money, they have all of this technological expertise, and they have this culture of urgency. You know, so they're going to do things like enhanced geothermal, which is a kind of non-controversial way to generate energy that's very, very promising. It's a huge wild card. And my theory is we could see situations where they generate so much energy that they have surplus energy, so that when they get their interconnection to the grid, they're actually selling cheap power into the grid instead of consuming power.
So these on-site nuclear reactors, they're like the ones that go onto ships, right? Is the kind of that
they
size?
They are. And there's a tremendous amount of innovation going on with small, they call them small modular reactors or SMRs. There's a lot of different types of SMR technology. The shipboard ones, I think, are really small-scale versions of your typical fission reactors, but they have a lot of ways to, you know, they're almost like batteries. They're the size of a shipping container. They put out 30 to 50 megawatts, and after, you know, 30 or 40 years, they just swap them out. They last that long. There's what they call radioisotope thermal generators, which are pebble bed reactors, which don't even require a transfer fluid. There's all kinds of technologies emerging with nuclear. So that's another one. And you want to talk about all of the above. They're also investing in natural gas, conventional natural gas power generation to the tune of 50, 60. There's 250 gigawatts of capacity nationwide just in natural gas power plant construction, and about a third of that's for data centers. That's an astonishing amount of power. They're using anything and everything they can find to make sure that we have more energy than we need, not less.
So this could be a good thing in the hopefully not too distant future. As you conjure up new articles for the next few months, are you seeing any interesting new trends that people should be watching out for and preview what you're going to be having on your website at the Cal Policy Center?
Well, you know, Barry, conjuring is not the word I would have chosen. You know, the next couple of weeks, I've got three teed up. We're going to talk about offshore, floating offshore wind. We're going to talk about dredging in the Delta. We're going to talk about large-scale desalination. Those are three things I'm looking at very carefully the last few weeks.
All right. Well, listen, thank you so much again for being on the show with us today, folks. Please follow Edward at the California Policy Center. I think that's californiapolicycenter.org. And he's a great writer, and you'll learn a whole lot. Edward, thank you so much for being with us. And, folks, thanks for being with us today. We'll see you next week with our next Protecting What Matters.
Join us next Tuesday for Protect What Matters the Most with Barry Fisher. Send your questions and show topic ideas to Barry at blazonbear.com.